Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
To you at home, the person that maybe has never been to New York, to stand outside the studio and scream, to come and sit in these chairs, to be this close to the guests, the ones that I've talked to every day just like this, and you've been here with music changes, etc. Thank you for being here. Enough of me. It's 1,000 show. Here's to 1,000 more. We have a great show for you today.
In 2003, the show that had become MTV's flagship show, Total Request Live, aired its 1,000th episode. It was still appointment television for young viewers, even as the boy bands broke up and Justin Timberlake went solo and Christina Aguilera got dirty with two R's, so you knew she meant it. MTV was faced with a challenge it had faced before: how to reach a new microgeneration of young viewers. But in the wake of TRL, the network was programming for 13-year-olds instead of the college students and young adults that it had once targeted. And the 13-year-olds of 2003 were a little different from the 13-year-olds of 1998. They weren't as into the boy bands as their big sisters. And they'd grown up with computers, chat rooms, AOL Instant Messenger. Social media would be right around the corner. The kids were ready. The executives at Viacom, the massive media conglomerate that now owned MTV, were not. On this episode, we'll take a look at the bus that MTV missed in the early aughts, the unexpected journey it ended up taking instead, and how the very things it brought to the culture were about to be the things that precipitated its decline. I'm Dave Holmes, and this is Who Killed the Video Star. In the years after the 1992 premiere of The Real World, though it was obvious how much less expensive unscripted television was to produce, pretty much only MTV was doing it. The Real World spinoff, Road Rules. The Road Rules spinoff, The Real World Road Rules Challenge. MTV did documentary-style programming focusing on musicians, like Making the Video, or Cribs. Or focusing on their fans, like Fanatic. And that was pretty much that, except for Jackass. Which, if you've seen Jackass, you know that there is nothing that I can do with my words, nothing our editors can do with sound clips to do it any justice. Just find Jackass wherever it's streaming and watch it, and don't get any stupid ideas. But in 2000, CBS aired a competition show called Survivor. Survivor was intense. Survivor contestants had to live on an island, kill and cook their own food, treat their own injuries, put themselves in situations that made you have to read the words "suppurating wound" in the entertainment section. Survivor was like nothing else that had ever been on television before, and viewers ate it up like so many island rats cooked over a fire. The ratings were huge. Within a couple of months, everyone had their copycat show, and within a couple of years, there was pretty much nothing else on TV. What we were now calling reality television was all over the programming grid. Every major network had its own massive franchise: American Idol on Fox, Fear Factor on NBC, The Bachelor on ABC. Reality was the industry buzzword, the way Extreme had been just a few years before. But the big ones were typically elimination shows. Everyday hopefuls competing for fame, or $1 million, or the chance to be engaged to some guy for a while. What nobody had tried, not yet, was a reality sitcom. As head of programming for MTV, Brian Graydon greenlit the first one.
Meet the perfect American family.
Jack, stop telling people you're all the only one's son to get into places. You're a fucking loser.
the Osbournes.
That's one that you could feel going in, especially when I saw the dailies. And the first footage I saw, we didn't really know what the show was going to be. We just sent cameras to their house because we thought they were so insanely entertaining in real life. And they had been featured on a small segment of Cribs where we had first seen the dynamic amongst the four primary family members. And that's what inspired us. And when the first dailies came back, we literally had Sharon throwing ham over the fence at her neighbors.
Darling, the Wicked Witch has nothing on me. You're already living next to the neighbor from hell. Come on, cocky what? Little Englishman.
And that was just kind of gold. You know, you can't tell someone to do that on reality TV. It's either authentic or it's not. I don't think any of us thought it would be the biggest show in the history of MTV, which it was to that point.
The Osbournes got ratings, and those ratings grew. The premiere of its second season got 6.6 million viewers, while even at its peak, TRL mostly hovered at just under 1 million. And it was pulling in an audience that was a little bit older. Damien Fahey was just starting his VJ career in 2003.
The biggest fan of the Osbournes that I knew at the time was my mother. She was obsessed with the Osbournes. She met Ozzy, you know, when he came by and Sharon, and she was, oh my God, she just loved the show. But that's interesting that I always thought it was such a show for young people, but it definitely reached an older audience.
The controversy before that one on the air was that we were putting on a 50 plus year old rock star, and MTV really thought of themselves as a channel for 25 year olds. And we kind of avoided anybody who was, God forbid, over 36. And that was the controversy, whether or not we should put somebody in the role of a father who was that old on TV.
In the wake of the Osbournes, celebrities found a new way to stay celebrities by having a camera crew follow them around and kind of just hoping for the best. It didn't always work.
The challenge was even the most A-level artists don't necessarily make good television, you know, as themselves. Jay-Z can write the most amazing lyrics on the earth, but, you know, he's unlikely to be a great reality television star. And so a lot of times we would opt for somebody like Nick and Jessica, who were arguably at the time more B-list than A-list, but the dynamic was so interesting that they made good TV. So I think there was a period where every celebrity thought, well, just give me a half hour, and it was never quite that easy.
With the Osbournes and then Newlyweds, MTV's ratings were stronger and more consistent than they had ever been. But the programming had less and less to do with music, much less music video. VJs like me and Damien didn't want to believe it, but the ratings didn't lie. And the ratings told MTV that a focus on music wasn't sustainable anymore.
MTV just didn't get heavy into reality because they wanted to get heavy into reality. They were seeing rating success, and executives are going to chase ratings so the ad sales department can do their thing. And it started to feel, A, like we were kind of shedding having a musical identity, and then it started to feel like a business.
In 2003, my contract at MTV ran out. The last show I worked on for the network was called Kidnapped. It was kind of an in-studio, five-day-a-week fear factor for kids.
Every time one of your friends makes a mistake, we are going to punish you by having our sadistic, evil clown throw a pie in your face. Let's put 2 minutes on the clock.
I really don't want to talk about it. When we get back, we'll talk about the big hits of the highest-rated years in MTV's history and the revolution that was brewing when the network wasn't watching.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Calling all pop culture enthusiasts.
Are you obsessed with all things celebrity?
Do you live for the drama, the laughs, and the unexpected moments that unfold on social media?
then you're going to want to tune in to the Comments by Celebs podcast.
I'm Emma.
I'm Julie.
And I'm Isabel.
Together, we run Comments by Celebs on Instagram and host the Comments by Celebs podcast. Join us 3 times a week as we deep dive into every aspect of pop culture.
Whether it's creating hypothetical scenarios, dissecting the latest trends, or just chatting about your favorite celebs, Comments by Celebs has you covered.
We start the week with a full-blown pop culture breakdown, analyzing all of the biggest headlines.
Next, we discuss all things Kardashians,
recapping current episodes or taking a trip down memory lane to relive some of their iconic moments from the past.
And for our final episode of the week, we serve you a full Bravo breakdown from recaps of Housewives, Vanderpump Rules, Summer House, and more. If it's going on in the Bravo world, we've got it covered.
We have new episodes out every week. Follow and listen to Comments by Celebs on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Even when I was there, you know, there was a joke. What is MTV? Is it the real, you know, is it Laguna Beach? Is it Jersey Shore?
That is MTV News correspondent Soo Chin Pak. She was there giving you the news at 10 to the hour every hour and working the red carpets at the Video Music Awards, even as she faced the eternal existential question of MTV.
Do you even play music videos anymore? When we were playing music videos and we had like multiple channels that just played music videos, right? Those conversations had been happening since I got there, right? Even when it was the only station, even when it was playing music.
In the early aughts, the music video blocks that MTV was still playing were still getting lousy Nielsen ratings. But MTV's celebrity shows were outrating even network television, something that would have been unheard of in the 80s and 90s. But that success came at the expense of its musical identity. At the time, Damian Fahey noticed the change on Total Request Live.
I mean, I noticed it because they were coming on the show on TRL more and more. And then I noticed when they hired Stephen Colletti, who was on Laguna Beach, he came on and he was hired as a VJ. And so I was like, oh, these shows are really making, you know, waves at the network. And then sort of having to interview people from Laguna Beach. And it just seems so silly because, you know, you go from interviewing someone like Bono or Madonna, Will Ferrell, to this is Britney from, you know, season 4 of, remember from like the hot tub scene where she like ate a jalapeno in the hot tub, whatever it was. And you got to like talk like for 4 minutes about like her like eating a jalapeno in like a hot tub. And it's just like, what are we doing? This is so stupid.
MTV News correspondent Chris Connolly was there to watch the network's shift to reality.
What you would say in retrospect is that when you go from being a channel that's defined by a culture, youth culture, and a loyalty to a demographic, to a channel that puts really big hits on the air, now you're like everybody else. Now you're chasing hits. And the culture picks up on what you've done and tries to emulate you. And that's a hard business to be in. That's like what primetime TV is. You need a hit sitcom. You need a hit TV show. You need a hit drama. Those are hard. Those are hard. You know, and so, you know, that was harder than getting the exclusive music video for Thriller, you know?
The massive rating success of early aughts MTV made Viacom shareholders and the MTV ad sales department very happy. But for the head of production, Brian Graydon, there was no time to celebrate.
You know, one of the things I realized is, as much as I would have liked to enjoy, say, The Osbournes when it was a big hit, that was usually when I was most nervous, because if we were getting 6-0 ratings on Tuesday nights, I knew that a year from now I had to top that somehow. And so we were always planning 2 and 3 years out with development with an eye towards topping where we were currently. That wasn't always possible, but you really never got to enjoy the moment too much because the moment was deceptive. And especially on MTV, everything burned out about 10 times faster than it would on other channels. So Seinfeld could get a full 9 seasons, but The Osbournes got 3 barely. And that was typical of MTV. Very few shows would last longer than that. So we just had to be this relentless machine cranking out stuff, given that that was the appetite of the youth audience watching what we were making. I can remember the shows that were about 10 times bigger than I ever dreamed. One of them was Pimp My Ride, if you remember that show, which was just a car makeover show.
I know you have aspirations to be a musician, so we're giving you a head start. We installed your own personal recording studio in your car.
It didn't go much deeper than that. It was a very engaging, entertaining show, but it wasn't, I wouldn't call it novel or new or different. But that exploded and became the number 1 hit around the world. And we could fill entire Saturday and Sundays with nothing but 24 hours of Pimp My Ride and get huge numbers.
In primetime, MTV had its big celeb reality shows. After The Osbournes and Newlyweds came The Ashley Simpson Show. In the wake of Fox's The OC, MTV premiered a glossy, high production value reality version, Laguna Beach, which led to The Hills. In the daytime, the network cranked out a series of teen dating shows, Room Raiders, Dismissed, Next. Former TRL head writer Tim Healy remembers.
I mean, it began to feel a lot less organic. And the more reality they did, the less real, you know, it started to feel. Like when we would do spring breaks, we would go and we would do shows that didn't have any music in them. You know, we would do crazy dating shows, or I did these crazy shows with Jerry Springer. And those shows had a format, right? Those shows had a script, but the kids weren't delivering lines, right? So it felt real, right? So as a viewer, I always thought that it was compelling and more dangerous knowing that, you know, these kids are on TV and anything can happen. Where a lot of those formatted shows, they did feel very canned. And I mean, look, it's because, you know, you're doing a show like Room Raiders or Next and you get a 60 episode order and, you know, and you're banging out a show in a day, you know, the producers just kind of fall into this blueprint where it's like, it becomes less about making a show and more about making a widget, right? It's like, okay, let's knock out these intros and, you know, they deliver this line to this camera and then they swing to that camera. And then, so it kind of becomes assembly line. And I think that's what you started to feel, I think, is, you know, low budget shows with a volume order and, you know, not much time in the schedule to shoot.
By 2008, Ashton Kutcher had wrapped his eighth and final season of the first and some say definitive iteration of Punk'd. The Jesse Metcalfs and Stacey Keiblers of the world heaved a sigh of relief. As Laguna Beach begat the hills begat the city. Tila Tequila took a shot at love. Girls with wealthy fathers and entitlement issues celebrated their super sweet 16s. And Rob Dyrdek, a legendary skater in the Jackass cinematic universe, went on adventures with his bodyguard in a show called Rob and Big. It felt like the torch was being passed again. In 2009, Brian Graydon decided to leave MTV. And you could say he went out on a high note.
We had just premiered Jersey Shore and 16 and Pregnant, which would then become Teen Mom. And those were two shows I had greenlit. And so it was actually on kind of a high that was running against trends on the strength of two shows. And I think it allowed MTV, because of the strength of those shows, to kind of stay in the bubble of the past even longer, because the metrics and the way you did the business in the past was still working for them on the strength of those shows. So it was kind of an illusion, if that makes sense.
Teen Mom was a rating smash, but Jersey Shore became American canon just about immediately. But for as big and era-defining as it was, the show had just about nothing to do with music. Unless you count Pauly D being a big Vegas DJ right now, which I don't. But I really want to see what those gigs are like. Anyway, journalist Rob Tannenbaum was starting to interview people for his 2011 oral history of the network, I Want My MTV. And the people he spoke to were not happy.
And what we saw over and over, you know, when we were doing interviews in 2009, 2010, the musicians we interviewed, they were apoplectic about these shows. Like, I've never seen anything so stupid in my life. They were angry at the shows MTV was playing. Now, they had no right to, particularly, because, you know, as we've been talking about, everybody has to get old and everybody has to be phased out of the thick of pop culture. But what they wanted was the glory days back. It wasn't so much that they hated the real world, although, you know, maybe they did. But it was less that than I want my youth back, right? That's one of the oldest stories in the world. I want my youth back. You know, and if what you really want is music videos, you know, not only do you not have to sit and wait for your video, you can go on YouTube. You can watch videos from 1965, every decade since then. You could spend the rest of your life watching music videos on YouTube, and you wouldn't even see a quarter of them. So why is MTV going to play videos? Just so people can feel young again? No. You want to feel young again, go to Sweden and get your blood changed.
Which brings us to Sumner Redstone. Sumner Redstone made billions in the entertainment business as the CEO of National Amusements, a chain of movie theaters. He took over Viacom, which owned MTV Networks, in 1987. In the mid-aughts, he was in his late 80s. And while to my knowledge he did not get his blood changed, he was still the CEO of Viacom. When we get back, we'll talk about the big changes he and the guy he eventually installed as his successor as CEO were not ready for, and how they were about to make MTV, and even traditional television in general, obsolete.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Big picture, the squandering of the MTV brand under the Viacom and now Paramount Global leadership is going to go down in history as one of the biggest wastes of brand equity in the history of media.
That is Matt Bellany. He's a co-founder of the digital media company Puck and the host of the podcast The Town. But in the aughts, he was a journalist for The Hollywood Reporter.
I mean, the fact that MTV has not successfully transferred over to the digital age is just a gigantic fail. It's a classic dilemma here. Like, they had this thing that was hugely popular and profitable for decades, and they failed to see what was coming. You know, Viacom sued YouTube when YouTube launched, and all of a sudden Daily Show and MTV clips were on YouTube. They sued it rather than figuring out what their own digital strategy was going to be.
Let's back up a little bit. For some background on what digital used to mean at MTV, here again is MTV van driver turned head writer of TRL, Tim Healy.
Look, when I started at MTV, we had to share computers, desktop computers. Like, you had to go to a sign-up sheet, and you would have to sign out an hour slot. And that's when you had access to the computer and you can write your scripts, right? And then the technology, it just took off.
You remember that trip that the early MTV executives took to Tulsa in 1982, where they found out that the network was resonating with young people because the local record stores were all sold out of Duran Duran? Well, 20 years later, there was another MTV executive trip. Sounds like it was a little better funded. And the information that that trip turned up was a little more ominous.
I remember Dave Cyrulnik, who was executive vice president at the time, and I remember a bunch of MTV executives took a trip to Japan. And I remember Dave coming back and basically saying they do everything on their phones in Japan. Like, they watch TV on their phones. They watch videos on their phone. And he said, and even in stores, they pay for things with their phone. They don't use credit cards or they don't use cash. And I remember, like, trying to wrap my head around that at the time. And it just seemed like science fiction, but it was pretty apparent to me that some of those upper-level executives saw the writing on the wall when they went on that trip.
We weren't all staring at our phones here in America, not yet. But the internet was more accessible than ever. Connection speeds were getting faster. Kids were online.
And I remember there was a big initiative on TRL to promote mtv.mobile.com/TRL. And if you're watching now, you can watch behind the scenes during the commercial breaks and mobile.mtv.secureserver.com/net. You know, it's like, no one's doing this. And so it was really like swimming against a very powerful current.
Gideon Yeago was a correspondent for MTV News back then.
So basically what happened was social networking became a thing. Friendster became MySpace. MySpace was a property that was being hotly courted by different media outlets. Ultimately, Fox was the one that ended up buying it and buying it out for a couple $100 million. And when that happened, Sumner Redstone said, "We need our social network. I cannot believe that you didn't in-house create one. And we need to be a bigger player in this space." And so there was this MTV Online push, which was the idea of doing broadband programming online to show that MTV was going to expand into the digital world. And it was like a half-assed version of it, right? Like it was like an old media brand essentially trying to be a like tech startup. Wasn't a bunch of people who were that familiar with tech, knew the space, could be that nimble or think that well. So there existed this kind of broadband programming like for the internet audience. And I think they went to Facebook and they tried to buy Facebook at that time, which was still, you know, a Harvard-based thing or was, you know, just becoming like, and I think Mark Zuckerberg asked them for $1 billion and they told him to go fuck himself because they don't pay that kind of money. And then I think within a year, all of the online stuff got yanked.
And by 2005, as YouTube is taking off, even people who loved MTV and wanted it to play more music are adopting YouTube as their own personal jukebox.
I remember the first time I discovered YouTube, and it was before an episode of TRL in a small little office that had a few computers in it. And Jamie Jasta, he was a rock VJ, and he was on this website watching concert videos. And I remember going, what is that? And he goes, oh, it's called YouTube. And I go, is it just, can I search anything? Like any like band? I could just watch like their video. He's like, yeah. I'm like, oh my God, that's like, I remember just like being like so excited, you know, thinking that's what I'm going to do when I go home. Like I'm going to cancel plans and just watch concert videos all night on YouTube. And that's what I did. And I went home that night and I was watching. And then I thought to myself, it hit me that, oh, if concert videos can be on this, then music videos can also be on this.
Here's Brian Graydon. In the mid-aughts, he's still the head of programming for MTV.
A lot of technology was premiering, but none had upended television. And then television, cable in particular, continued to be a growth business up until like 2010, 11. So that, you know, initially you're quite nervous, but then a few years pass and nothing much seems to happen. And so you lull yourself into thinking, oh, this must be like movies and TV. They can both exist. But ultimately, there were profound consequences. The one that was most apparent for MTV was that on YouTube, I could watch just the videos I wanted to watch, and I didn't have to wait for the VJ to tell me what was next and what I'd be watching. And there was no way we could ever win in the music video business again on air, and that was pretty apparent pretty early on. But it was also one of those things you didn't want to speak out loud because you still had TRL at the height of its popularity and music videos were still core. But that was the thing that most alarmed me initially was I could program it as a viewer.
YouTube had all the videos, with the added benefit of them being on demand, something TRL and MTV could never give you.
You know, the ability to be able to go onto this website and type in anything you wanted to see and have it pop up, you had to be a blind person not to see that that was where it was all heading.
MTV wasn't blind, but they weren't prepared either.
I remember when YouTube started and, you know, when Facebook started, it was sort of seeing the way the record companies felt about MP3s, which was, we got to shut this down. This will be nothing. We're the record company. We've got all, you know, and that's kind of the analogy that I would make is there was a bit of this pompous attitude that this will never go anywhere. Kids are always going to need a place to see their favorite celebrities. They'll never get closer than this.
And, you know, I got to be honest, I think by the time we were in the waning days of TRL, MTV was kind of like a big, gigantic aircraft carrier. Like, it's not impossible to turn the thing around, but it's going to take a hell of a long time.
It's also possible that the decision makers at Viacom, like Sumner Redstone's successor as CEO, Philippe Dilmon, just didn't know how to steer.
In a time where things were starting to move very quickly because of things like YouTube and Facebook, and they can be more agile, that was not the time to have like 7 meetings about what color the MTV mobile font should be, you know.
YouTube was a threat. And because Viacom hadn't yet figured out how to work with it, they did what a massive corporation does. They sued it. Here's Sally Fertini-Hess.
For years, there was a lawsuit back and forth because a lot of our proprietary content was starting to get uploaded onto YouTube. And this was before there was rights deals made. Now every single network or platform has a YouTube channel, and other companies like the NFL or NBA, whatever, made deals with YouTube and figured out how to monetize it. But we sued them. You know, now everyone looks at YouTube as an extension and a promotional platform, right? And Instagram and Facebook and everything else. But back then it was competition. So no one was like, you know, maybe we should embrace this because they've got the technology. You know, Google bought YouTube, right? They have the technology. We didn't have that tech. We weren't in the technology business at that time.
With YouTube and early social media, the interactivity that had made Total Request Live so popular was now available to everyone, everywhere, all day long. A new age was arriving, and the high-up executives of MTV's parent company, Viacom, unlike the Warner Amex executives of 1981 who stayed out of the way and let the young people cook, got themselves very involved. They didn't know what to do, but they also didn't know how to get out of the way.
You might also remember that the boss that I revered, Tom Freston, was fired because he didn't buy MySpace, you know, for not being forward enough. So I found that doubly ironic that then the replacement CEO seemed to want nothing to do with the unfolding digital future, just wanted more ratings and more ad dollars. And that formula was the power formula for about 20 years, but it was no longer the right formula in the mid-10s, which eventually then caught up with him as well.
After Tom Freston was fired, Sumner Redstone installed his longtime right-hand man, Philippe Domont, as CEO of Viacom. Philippe was more of a bean counter than a music guy. He was more interested in a good quarterly earnings call than staying relevant in popular culture. And on his watch, MTV's personality faded away even further. Here's Gideon Yeago from MTV News.
I remember the commercials that MTV had for MTV out of the promos department vividly as a viewer, and I could not name one as someone who worked there, you know, because it was too precious. You weren't going to like give up 30 seconds of ad time once you were part of this big conglomerate. Like, fuck no, that's leaving money on the table. Like, why would you have an in-house group of filmmakers and animators and like creative geniuses burn through that kind of cash? Once it started to skew away from a model that, you know, there was just these gaps that you could fill with cool shit because of, I don't know, the ways that music videos were programmed, it lost that identity.
And increasingly, it lost the kids.
Kids like anti-establishment, you know, and I think, I don't even know if it ever could have worked because at that point, MTV, you had social media, which was seen as like the hip, cool new thing. And so I almost feel like inevitably the brand of MTV was starting to age in the eyes of teenagers. I remember hearing like from kids, oh, I don't watch that. That's my older brother's network. My older sister watches MTV. I watch YouTube and I'm on like Facebook and I'm on MySpace, you know, whatever the thing was, which is so, that's kind of the beauty of getting older as you realize like how corny the cool thing you were into, like it actually was like a completely like corporate thing.
By the late aughts, YouTube is chipping away at MTV. The 2006 Video of the Year VMA went to Panic at the Disco's I Write Sins, Not Tragedies, a video I don't think they ever actually played on the network. Total Request Live got less live, shooting a week's worth of episodes in a day with no screaming kids outside. It was a cost-cutting maneuver.
The point in time where I realized it was over was once TRL started being pre-recorded and it was no longer live because it was cheaper to record two shows Monday, two shows Tuesday, and then do like a live show on Wednesday, whatever. And so I go, okay, that's not good. And it also just took a lot of the fun out of, it just isn't the electricity. There isn't like the, and so that was lost, I think. We're pre-recording a show that, you know, sells itself as being live, you know, it's in the title of the show.
Total Request Live lasted for a decade. Kind of an eternity in MTV years when you think about it. The last TRL aired live on MTV in November of 2008. Beyonce was there. Justin Timberlake was there. We invited an up-and-coming 18-year-old country crossover artist to come and get everyone to sign her TRL yearbook. Hold on, let me see if I can find her name. Sorry. Oh, yeah. Taylor Swift. The last proper number one on the TRL countdown was She Got Her Own by Neo with Jamie Foxx and Fabulous. Does not ring a bell for me either. After that, the big studio overlooking Times Square went dark. The last peep show was over. And it wasn't just MTV. By this time, Top of the Pops, that long-running BBC chart show that inspired the first generation of music video stars, aired its last show in 2006, Shakira's Hips Don't Lie was its last number one. No fighting. According to Soo Chin Park, it's the circle of life.
When I sit down with a person who, say, under 25, it's like going into a time machine and you are Father Cricket. And it's not even like, back when we used to have music videos, it's like, no, go further. Back when there was no social media, go farther. And so then you start to paint yourself into a corner of like, what even am I talking about? Like, why am I even talking to this young person who's like, a VJ, okay, a VJ is someone who on TV, oh, TV, okay, hold on, a channel. Like, my kids don't know what a channel is. Like, change the channel? What do you mean change? What channel? TV. I mean, we have a TV monitor, but we all watch TV mostly on our laptops. TV, I mean, it's just the size of a screen.
Things change, especially in the world of media, especially as technology advances exponentially. You can't get too attached to any one thing. But while we were recording interviews for this podcast, we witnessed the death of something truly important to us and to the people we were interviewing, and to a lot of America, including, if you've been listening this whole time, you. In our next episode, we'll tell the whole story and we'll pour some out for MTV News. Who Killed the Video Star? The Story of MTV is written and narrated by me, Dave Holmes. Executive produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman, Dave Holmes, Jim Weber, and Chris Cowan. Our story editor is Maddie Sprung-Kaiser. Produced by Lloyd Lockridge, Ian Mont, and Terrence Malangone. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil. Production support by Javier Cruces. Special thanks to J.D. Crowley, Maura Curran, Leah Reese-Dennis, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Allison Jeffrey, and Hilary Schuff. Who Killed the Video Star? The Story of MTV is an Odyssey original.
It's Sophia Franklin, and I have a little secret to let you in on. I know you've all wanted more of me, so I'm introducing you to my brand new mini-series that's out now. More of me, more of you, more of us, every Monday.
Bringing back all the OG feels that initially brought us together.
Listen and follow Sophia with an F on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.